Welcome to Hearing Voices from NPR. I'm Jay Allison, and this is a special from the public radio website, transom.org, where you can get the tools to tell your own story. This hour, we have audio diaries from two people who did just that. They told stories about their own personal transformation. The first one comes from Miles Taylor. Miles was born in the wrong body. He was born Megan. He chose the name Miles and over many months began his slow and difficult transition into manhood. And he brought an audio recorder with him. This is his story, as produced by Sarah Reynolds.
It's interesting that so much can be attached to your name. I've kind of already divorced myself a little bit from Megan. It feels separate from who I am now. And I really haven't latched on to Miles yet. Some days I feel more Miles than Megan. It's kind of weird. I have no problem saying Megan Taylor. Megan Taylor. No, I need to say Miles Taylor, but I need to say it in an ownership sort of way. Hello. It's 9:10 on February 2nd. I am still at work. The only people who are here are the people who are cleaning. So I'm not actually working, but I am working on the letter to my parents. I need to talk to you two about something. Months ago, I started writing you a long letter, but having edited and revised and picked and poked at it for so many months, it started to feel more like a paper for school. I have a gender identity disorder. I've had it my entire life without really being able to put a name to it, and it has become severe to debilitating the past couple of years. My body may appear and function as female, but in my head I have never felt a connection to my body. The sex of my body is female, but the gender I feel in my head is male. To break that down another level...
In the beginning, I definitely felt more Megan than Miles. Then there was an awkward period in the middle, which I'm still kind of wading through right now, which is where you kind of lose your identity, and you don't know who you are.
I'm now going to get the hell out of here. I'm just going to shut down shop. I think I'm done for the day. Intro, take one. My name is Megan Taylor. I am 28 years old. I am a financial analyst / accountant. I've loved math my entire life, and I think it's because it makes sense. And it's universally understood. There's an answer. There's always an answer. And, you know, it's not subjective. It is a very clear answer.
If I only had 30 seconds to describe what transition means, this part right here doesn't count because I can't even think about trying to describe it in 30 seconds. Because it's different for everyone, and that's what I'm going to say. So transition to me means finding a place... Damn, starting over. Transition to me means... pretty much finding a place of self-acceptance and self-love. That's really my ultimate goal. It's not to be hairy, although I would like to say I'd like to have a penis. But the whole thing is trying to find who you are. I don't like being a female in this world. And even on a desert island, alone, I wouldn't want to be a female. I'd still want to be a male. I want to have a male body. Even when I started therapy, I went in, and I hadn't even thought about the social aspect of being a man. It wasn't a factor for me. It's always been physical. I've hated my body so much that to me it was just anything I could do to get rid of this body.
I am currently getting ready to go. I'm getting ready to go out to dinner with Sharon and Noreen, and they are coming by to pick me up. And right now I'm putting my binder on, which is kind of a cheap binder. I haven't made the investment to get a nice one. It's basically like a neoprene. I think that's too tight. Like a weightlifting belt. I wrap it around and it keeps everything secure and flattens. And I put a white undershirt on and then a button down, and you really, it kind of just looks like I have some pretty serious pec action going on as a guy. Restaurants are always interesting because I think I always get read as male, and then once I get read as male, then I like it, but then I also don't want to open my voice because, or open my mouth and speak. It's a giveaway. I'm trying to learn how to lower my voice without straining it, but I just don't think that that's really possible. I think I'm ready to go.
I definitely think I'm coming out a second time. I even had that in my letter to my parents that I've come out to you before as a lesbian, and I'm coming out to you again right now as transgender.
The term, much less the concept of being transgender, was unavailable to me growing up. Not by any fault of your own, it's simply the world in which we lived. I understand that this decision affects everyone in my life. And knowing me as well as you do, I would hope that you would understand that I would never put anyone through this if it weren't absolutely necessary. I've always known I was different, but I know now that it was only covering up what I feel I've known all along, what I've known since I was 6 years old when I began putting a sock into my pants when I was alone, or when I used to pretend to shave my face with toothpaste and a toothbrush. What I'm trying to explain here is that there has always been a disconnection with my gender and my physical body, and I have tried endlessly to figure out what was wrong, why I simply didn't feel right in my skin. For the first time in my life, though, I am starting to feel a connection to who I am.
I'm going to say 5'9". I'm between 5'8 and 5'9", but I like to say 5'9". And my hair is short.
The sides are like an inch long.
My cheeks are...
I'm also like really paranoid about this.
Not hollowed out, but they...
I know that I'm going to gain
weight there from testosterone. It's just going to kind of redistribute and my face will fill out.
My eyebrows are the bane of my existence.
They don't grow.
And I think that that'll minimize my cheekbones.
And I used to pluck my eyebrows and so...
make my jaw a little stronger.
But I still think that that's probably the most feminine part of my face, or at least I feel like that my eyes are...
I mean, I think that my jaw's already pretty strong, but...
and my cheekbones.
I don't know.
Kind of what gives away my feminine quality.
So when I'm looking straight on...
I also have a very expressive face.
Or I can scowl a little. It's I don't know. I try to get... if I could ever get the corners of my eyes to go down. I'm actually, like, hoping that my eyes will sag a little, which, I mean, who hopes for that?
When I look in the mirror, I know I am seeing me, but I have become so detached from the reflection that it is nearly as though I am seeing the body of someone else, some other female-bodied person.
Okay, I'm probably about 2 days shy of starting my period, so I don't know what it is, but when leading up to it, it almost seems like my face feminizes, or actually characteristics on my face have softened. But I just know that pretty much without fail, every month at this time, I can look in the mirror and, I mean, there's a sense of gloom, really, I'll be honest, that goes over me because I feel feminine, and I don't know. I mean, it obviously could have something to do with my hormone levels and, you know, my body insisting that it is a female body.
I think it says something about my character that I haven't given up.
You know, I wasn't really growing a lot for a lot of years. I was merely existing. And I mean, I can't change the past now, so my hope is that I'm going to turn into one of those people that crams a lot of life into every day.
Hello. I'm walking home. It's really quiet. Just an easy walk to make.
except when it's, you know, 10 degrees outside. I had to make this walk yesterday as well. I went out with a friend, and on my way back, I called my parents. And, like, the first thing out of their mouth is, "You're walking alone in the dark? Is it safe? You know, is it a well-lit area?" And it was just that immediate protective parent act. And the only thing going through my head is, like, I'm not necessarily going to get raped out here. I would more so get mugged and beaten because I look like a guy and I walk like a guy. I think that they, you know, maybe they just think I'm out here with a purse or something. I'm just a sitting target, you know. I think that I'm getting a little worked up with my parents. They're weighing on my thoughts. But it's time. They need to know. There's not an alternative. There's no way to protect them. And I'm doing them a disservice by not telling them. I'm not giving them a choice right now.
For the past few months, I have been living my life as male everywhere with the exception of my work. Basically, what that means is that all of my friends have been using male pronouns when referring to me and have been addressing me by another name. The name I have chosen is Miles.
What really solidified Miles for me was when I looked up the meaning of it, and in Latin it means soldier. I can get super, super dorky here. If you do the alphanumeric calculation of your name, Megan and Miles is the same. And I even remember going to the bathroom and looking in the mirror, and I had on a blue shirt that day, and I think I look very nice in blue, personally. Cute and boyish. It's my favorite color. And I remember looking in the mirror and being like, and I said it, I even said it out loud, I was like, Miles could work. I think that that works for me. And so Chris and I went out to eat that night, and I was like, all right, I think I have a name. And then I told him, and his response was, oh, I like that. That works.
Sharon and Noreen and Chris, they've basically been my family through this.
So what day is today, Chris? What's going on?
Today is the day when Miles goes out to his parents as trans man. But it is happening today.
It needs to.
It needs to happen.
I mean, if it, I'm going to have this exact same feeling if I bump it back a week.
Yeah, you are.
So
I think this is a weekend is this weekend is as good as any.
I'm delivering this information to you in the form of a letter for a couple of reasons. One, I never would have been able to say all of this to you in person without completely losing any and all composure. And two, I wanted to give you a safe space in which you could react however you need to react, without worry of judgment, as I realize this is not easy news to hear. Easy news for any parent to hear. I know you have most likely envisioned how my life would turn out, and I doubt this is anywhere close to what you had in mind. Frankly, it wasn't what I had in mind either. However, I know this is right for me. You would not be sitting here reading this letter if that were not the case.
How about, it's really important to me that you and Daddy read this together. You're going to hear me say this again in the letter, but I really am okay. I'm doing well.
Honestly, you're overthinking it.
I know, she's going to fly through this.
She's going to fly through it because this is not the meat of the issue. She's going to see how long the letter is, and she's going to be like, okay, this is really far less important.
Yeah, I know.
The thing that this should be doing, if anything, is
stalling.
Not stalling. I'm saying not inciting panic.
Yeah, so that's shut up. Decent page breaks.
It's beautifully paragraphed.
I wanted to, because I'm used to, whenever you...
Just send it! I can't take it anymore.
Here goes.
I love you.
Yeah.
Do you need a hug?
I'm glad to have it done.
Mm-hmm. She'll do what she needs to do, and I think that...
She's a mother. She's gonna eat the burnt piece of toast. She's gonna look out for me.
But that's what makes her feel good at the same time, Miles. Like, you can't deny that. Like, you know, you feel so guilty for that, but at the same time, it's like...
You know, she wants to look out for you. It's, you know, part of what she lives for.
Can we just sit and wait?
We can go somewhere.
No, I think we need to wait. I think she's going to call me back.
I just checked my email because I haven't heard from my mother. The email started with M.
M?
M. It said M, oh. Dash. And she never does that. She always says, darling daughter, or Megan.
Right. That's good, right? That's gotta be
good. It is good. That's why I don't want to read the rest.
You need to, because I'm going to drive myself nuts. Can you read it aloud?
I have to read it aloud.
All right.
It says, no matter what you do, it will not affect your relationship with us. Those are Daddy's exact words. He is, however, still digesting. I'm not as surprised as she might think, but I dread the further anguish you will endure. Health risks are a big concern. There are lots, in capitals, lots of questions. Bottom line, we will always love you. Do hope you already knew that. Love you, Infinity. M, which is that's my mom's sign-off.
I just got out of work, and I'm walking down so I can catch the bus to get to my group meeting tonight. I have my trans guy support group, which it meets once a month. We meet in a private room, and depending on the month, you know, it varies how many guys are there. I want to go this time because I want to talk to them about the kind of testosterone that I want to get, because I have my physical tomorrow, and I don't know, I just want to get some suggestions.
I don't think that I'm going to change my mind. The worst that would happen after 4 months is my voice would lower, and I'd be a very husky lesbian with no boobs. I'm about 3 months away from surgery. Hello, good morning. I'm about to do my shot.
Right now, I'm getting the testosterone out.
I'm gonna do it in my left thigh today.
My needle. All right. Oh, it's pushing back, so now I gotta shove the air in.
I will need to have testosterone for the rest of my life. I wonder if my voice has changed a little, but I really don't know. It's March 24th, and this is my voice, 20 days on testosterone.
This is my voice, 22 days on testosterone.
Today is April 1st, and
today is April 9th,
28 days on testosterone.
So 5 weeks, so that's going
to be 35,
so 37.
Today is April 22nd, and this is my voice,
49 days on
April 23rd, 50 days on testosterone.
47, today is the 23rd.
Today is May 5th, this is my voice. 62 days on testosterone.
Today is May 11th, and this is my voice. 68 days
today
on
is
testosterone.
May 18th, and this is my voice. 75 days on testosterone. I have surgery in 4 days, so there's nothing that I can really do at this point to prepare anymore for surgery. Right now, it's really just a matter of decreasing the stress. And if lifting weights makes me feel like I've done a little more, which it does, then, you know, that's what I'm going to do.
That's 5, 6.
I just got to work, and I just kind of wanted to document this moment because this is the last time that I am going to be at work as Megan. This is my last official Megan day. This is the last day I'm going to be using the women's restroom. This is the last time that I will have my email say Megan Taylor. This is the last time I'll be sitting here on this curb with my bike and feel the sweat under my binder. You don't get the breeze that goes under your shirt because it hits this stupid thick binder, and so you just get all sweaty in there. It's just a lot of lasts. There's a lot of lasts happening. Imagine it's just, I mean, I know it's not all boob related, but there are a lot of boob blasts. And I mean, once I get back and work is miles, and all I need to do is get my name changed and get all my paperwork changed, then pretty much my life is going to be miles. I think that I've been split between these two identities since, like, August. So that's 9 months. It's a long time. All right, over and out. My list before surgery. So it was 109 lines before we get to the grocery store shopping list. Alrighty. We have vitamins, scar treatment, acidophilus, button-down pajama top, button-down shirts, wet ones or baby wipes, bendable straws, large safety...
The last day with my boobs. On a long handle. I don't look at them anymore. I just know that I hate them.
Clothes. I have button-down shirt, 5 of those. 2 khakis, 2 board shorts, loose pajama top, loose pajama bottoms, my blue ones.
I've had intermittent moments of doubt. But it's not doubt and that I think that I'm doing something wrong. I think that it's just because it's such a big thing that it would almost be weird to not have doubt on some level.
Vitamins, AM, PM, bromelain, Artica, medications. It's my normal lineup of antidepressants and anti-anxieties.
I don't know. I think that I just don't pay a lot of attention to them these days because I have my routine. I get up in the morning. I put my binder on. Every single day that I do that, though, I think I can't wait for the day until I don't have to do this.
Video camera, audio recorder and mic, testosterone, needles, alcohol, cotton balls, DVDs, books, and then a list of...
Finding Miles, produced by Sarah Reynolds, continues in a minute on Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
This is Hearing Voices from NPR. Welcome back. You're listening to Finding Miles from the public radio website transom.org. It's a story of transition from female to male and living in the space between. This audio diary was kept over the course of a year as Megan became Miles. If you would like more information about the transgender community, check out the Human Rights Campaign at hrc.org. Miles also spent a lot of time on YouTube finding videos of people who had also transitioned from female to male. Without this online community, he says, he couldn't have made it through. And now, the conclusion of Finding Miles.
Okay, well, are we ready to go?
I'm ready to go. Take the longest amount of time.
Is your computer off?
No.
Monitor off?
Monitor's off. Computer's off.
Looks like it's off. Let's go.
Apparently you woke up and you said, no visitors.
Yes. I don't remember any of that. So yeah, I went into surgery at around 9, out by 11, and the doctor came out and talked to Sharon and Chris. And he said that everything went great, basically. Pain-wise, I still feel quite a bit of pain.
What kind of pain does it feel like? A tightness?
It feels like a tightness. The undersides where the scars, where the incision is. My scars, basically, they follow right along my pectoral line. Thinking of a woman's breast, if you lifted the breast up, the crease where
the breast hits the rest of your body. That's more or less where the scar line is. As you develop your pectoral muscles, it just kind of looks more like a crease than a scar. Surgery so far has definitely been the largest expense. My surgery was $5,700. Every dollar I spend, I think, is it worth it? Do I really need this? Or should I put that into my surgery fund? I still have probably another $30,000 in surgeries. You know, I tried my hardest to be a girl because it was too hard to not fit in. You know, I had long hair and it's so weird. Yeah, it was like, who can look at me and say that this looks right in any way? I can show up and be me, and I don't have to show up and be someone else. I mean, God, last year sucked. I felt like I was, you know, carrying around this secret my parents didn't know, and you want to just kind of, like, scream at them, like, I have this news. You know, something's changing, and I look like a man. But now they know. They're really trying, and it's always a big to-do when I return to Texas for the holidays, just because I don't see him all the time.
We've had this tumultuous year of all the emotions and the, as you said, the mourning and the, you know, and then to finally get you here. And by this time, you know, now we've been waiting and waiting and waiting to see you and meet, you know, say, oh, here's Miles. But anyway, and there you were. And it was just like, oh, shoulders are bigger.
Yeah.
The hug.
Yeah, that's what
but, does. But you appear to me to be happy in your own skin.
Because I'm still here and I'm still alive. Mm-hmm. So it's not like I died. But you said that you lost a daughter.
The hardest thing was the loss.
I mean, you...
And it's, you know, the sad thing, I mean, here you are, flesh and blood, warm, wonderful, lovable, our child.
Do you still feel like that?
No, I don't anymore, but I mean...
Initially.
I felt like the child that I knew...
Was forever
and
gone.
And the child that's in the picture on the icebox that I knew and grew up with was gone. Just pure and simple, was gone.
I just felt like somebody had taken a cannonball and shot it right through my middle, and that I was walking around living my life and going to work and doing everything and acting normal, except that I had this huge hole. It was just there all the time. It was there when I got up in the morning. It was there when I went to bed at night. It was just there. But the other thing, and I know it's the maternal guilt thing. I don't know if Daddy has these same things, but I feel you have done like this heroic feat. You've accomplished this on your own. Without, I mean, even though you've always known that you have our total love and support, but that's all you had from us. We weren't actually holding your hand. Mm-hmm. And I still have the text messages I got when you got out of surgery.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Anyway, well, I love you. Yeah. Always have, always will. It's really nice to spend time with you.
Very nice to be here. Mm-hmm. You know how, like, when a movie comes to the conclusion and it culminates with someone, like, standing outside, and, you know, and it's just kind of like that sigh, that, you know, that breath of just, oh. I ran around without a shirt on for the first time outside. We had the reprieve from the cold weather, and it got a little warmer, and it was drizzly, and I went to the park, shed my layers, and... You know, cool breeze on my chest, and it was absolutely amazing. All right. My name is Miles, and I am 29 years old. So this is me signing off, and this is my voice, 260 days on testosterone.
Finding Miles was produced by Sarah Reynolds and edited by me, Jay Allison, with support from Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Thanks to Vicki Merrick, Samantha Brown, Joe Richman, Holly North, Rob Rosenthal, and Chris Jacobs, and a special thanks to Miles for his willingness to tell a difficult story as he was living it. Miles spent just over a year with a microphone recording his story. Having the recorder was like talking things out to himself, he says, so that he could make sense of something that was foreign to most of the people in his life. Here's Miles.
I wanted to be able to look back on this later, maybe. And I think the awareness around trans issues is starting to gain momentum. There's not a lot of information on it, which is kind of surprising. The one piece of advice that I would have is do research. I mean, I know people on YouTube now talk about how they get questions from, you know, younger guys, you know, pre-T, pre-everything, wondering about transition. And I sat there for hours upon hours watching videos, and I was just fascinated by the changes, by the physical changes. Mostly it was the physical changes. And I think that it really gave me hope. Just seeing the people and knowing and hearing again and again how much happier people were. Everyone recognized that, you know, family stuff is hard, job stuff is hard, you know, surgery. But with all of that going on, everyone was happier that they had started hormones and started transitioning and being true to who they were. And you just kind of have to jump.
This is Hearing Voices from NPR. You're listening to a special feature from the public radio website transom.org. We're featuring radio diaries about transformation. This one comes from Lewis. He decided not to use his last name. Lewis used to rob people on the street and decided he wanted to stop. Running From Myself was produced by Lewis with Anthony Mascaro from 826 NYC and was featured on transom.org.
It's me and him, and then behind them, and then behind them is his boys, and then next to his boys is you. So all of y'all ready to do something, because all of y'all had your hands in your pocket, so I know most of y'all must have something on y'all.
You're mentioning like I was against you, dude.
Nah. You was with me. No, you know what happened? While dude was talking to me, I was thinking, yo, if I pull out my knife, the Sylvia have my back. yo, if I get him and he gets me, will Sylvia have my back? Yo, I was dead ass thinking that.
Thanks for questioning my loyalty.
Nah. It's cause I was thinking like, if I do this, what's gonna happen?
Cause I'm Lewis, 18 years old, raised in the Bronx, and this is me and my boy Sylvia having a talk. You see, I spent my 4 years of high school stealing and selling drugs, mostly mugging other kids and people in nearby neighborhoods. I never got caught. In the beginning of my senior year, I decided to stop, to change my life, to leave the old me behind. The point of this conversation with Silvio was to speak about the change I've made. At that time, I felt I changed my way of thinking, but as I hear it now, I noticed the pride in that voice. I felt so alive retelling my crime. Now I wonder if the change of mentality I claim is real. Sure, I haven't robbed anyone in a while, but if my attitude about it is the same, then what's really changed? Can I say I'm any different? Can I be sure I won't start stealing again tomorrow? I don't know. I remember having the same pride when I spoke to my friend Anthony about the first time I robbed someone, about how in 8th grade, my friends and I jumped a guy and stole his chain and jacket. I remember talking about the excitement I felt. Excitement that I wanted to relive as I told Anthony my story. We ran like for like 2-3 blocks or something, and then turned the corner and ran some more, and then ran into a building. And my heart was beating super fast, and like my face was red, and I was like breathing heavy, but yeah, I had a lot of energy. And then there we all start like laughing for like what we did, and then we all like feeling all good, and like me personally, like it felt real good, like just robbing somebody and like taking their stuff, and it kind of put me in a position of power, and power feels good to anybody. So robbing somebody and just leaving there all vulnerable and taking the stuff felt real good. Like, I felt the rush. I felt the adrenaline. And, like, I kind of wanted more. Like, I was like, yo, there's no problem with this. I could do this. It feels good.
When you guys were actually on the guy, did it feel the same way then? Or did it feel, is there, like, an element of maybe something's going to go wrong?
I don't know about my other friends, but me, I was thinking, like, I hope nobody calls the cops on us. I hope nobody, like, somehow gets, like, our fingerprints. And, like, because, like, if we get caught by the cops, then my mom finds out. And my mom finds out, you know, that's, like, the worst thing that can happen to me. Because, like, I want my mom to know what I'm doing. You know, she's going to get all mad and disappointed and this and that. And for me, like, disappointment hurts more than any other type of emotion. So I just didn't want her to find out. That was my only fear. I gave up Dylan stealing when I was a high school senior, but how long can I keep the animal caged? There are nights when I'm outside and I do feel like robbing someone, but I don't act on it. I've spent 4 years lying and hiding my dirt from my family. Regaining their love and trust was a difficult task, and I don't want to risk losing it again. I wish my brain had a reset button so I can erase my past. Maybe a reminder the old me will clear these uncertainties. The only person who can help me with this is Eugenia. She's been my close friend and support throughout my 4 years in high school. I'm going to call her up and see what she has to say. What up, Eugenia? How you doing?
Hi, Louis. What's up?
Nothing. Chilling. Yo, I was just calling you up because you know me mad long for like 4 years and everything. So,
yeah.
Because you know me that long, you basically have seen how I've changed throughout these years. So I just want you to, like, describe to me how I was when you met me, like, what you thought of me when you first saw me, like, what kind of person you thought I was from mm-hmm. then to now.
Yeah, I can do that. When we first met, I thought you were very immature because you and your hat there, the ghetto, you know, the baggy clothes, always the gray, the white, and the black. And then I started getting to know you a little bit more, you know, as the years went by. And I started realizing that you were hiding something. We started talking more and more and more, and I started telling you about my thing. And we started talking as friends more than friends. You were like my brother to me.
Right.
And as we are now.
Yeah, right, sister.
And then, though, like early September, we were in Miss Chang's class. You sat right behind me. I remember going to the classroom, saying hi to everybody else, and then the late bell ringing and seeing your seat empty. And it wasn't just like one day at a week or something. It was basically like 3-4 days. And everybody was asking, where's Louis? And I would have to make some excuse, oh, he's sick or his mom is doing something or whatever. Until I got to the point where there was no more excuses to give. And it was all because of the streets. You were out in the streets stealing and seeing my brother, my best friend, going downhill.
Mm-hmm.
It was a pleasant being there to see you let yourself go.
Right. No, I really feel you on that.
But then you started talking, oh, I'm not even going to go to college. I'm not going to fill up any application. And I got pissed. I really just didn't want to talk to you anymore because you were so strong throughout the years, and then now it's like you don't want anything. And even though you said you didn't care, the face you had when you received your report card, no, it's just horrible. Yeah. And you know me. I seriously did not want to talk to you at all. I didn't want to talk to the lazy bum.
Okay.
And having all the support there, hi. All
right, if you put it that way, damn. You're being mad harsh.
You know I still love you.
Talking to Eugene made me realize I really messed up. As she described me, I felt sorry for myself because I was so ignorant at that time. But I also felt hate for the person she was describing because I knew I could have stopped long ago, but waited till the last year of high school to start changing. After a conversation, I flashed back to the moment I robbed my first victim and thought of the reasons I decided to do it. The only explanation that came to mind was that I was tired of being poor. My stepdad left my mom a few months before and she was stuck with all the bills. I was now the man of the house and I felt I had to be strong and bring in some sort of income, at least for myself. I tried to get a job, but no one wanted to hire a 13-year-old. I've matured since then and realized that much of my macho views came from my stepfather. He wasn't the best father figure, but I did look up to him. He was kind to me when he entered my life. But as the years went by, he began calling me weak and overweight and would say I was exaggerating whenever my emotions would get hurt. To him, name calling was a game, but not to me. When he left, I did cry. Not because he was leaving, but because I couldn't hit him. Today I wonder how else he's impacted my life, and if his teachings helped lead me to the bad choices I've made. To answer this, I'm going to need a professional's opinion. I know just the person to speak to. There's a social worker by the name of Erica at the violence prevention program I go to. I hope her analysis can help. I just want you to, like, tell me from your perspective as a social worker, what are my issues with my past, and like, I want to know how will it affect me later on and with my involvements with other people. So I mean, you're free to say whatever you want.
Okay, well, I think you're taking a big step in dealing with it simply by being involved in this program, because it's a violence prevention program. And with gender roles, we've done so much work on that, the man box. And from what I understand from your history, your stepfather was a very negative influence, and the original abandonment by your birth father, that has an impact, because as early as infancy, you're learning from the people around you. And by not having a father there, where are you getting the sense of manhood? How are you supposed to learn what it is to be a real man when you're not surrounded by one? So you have this man come into your life who sometimes is nurturing and sometimes is like really super harsh on you, like you better be strong and carry this and don't cry because only girls cry. When you're getting all of that, it's not only giving you a negative sense of what it is to be a man, but it's also putting down women. At what point you start hurting other people, whether it's mugging and robbing, threatening and scaring, that comes from a place inside of you where you don't feel good about yourself. You don't respect yourself. So you're willing to do the despicable. Because if you had any self-worth, you wouldn't do that to another person. But you don't have the self-worth because you have the messages embedded in you that you're a wimp, you're a whiner, you're a girly man, you're not a real man, you're not strong, and that you're too sensitive. Because didn't you get tagged with that label that you were too sensitive because you were so close to your mother?
Yeah, but like, I never did the stealing thing because self-hatred. I respect myself to the fullest.
Then the tough question is, why did you do it?
Because like, during the time I was stealing, I noticed, you know, my mom's having a problem with the bills. My mom's struggling, and I hate seeing it. I hate seeing my mother suffer. So what I figured was that, you know what? So many people out there are doing what's wrong and getting what they want. So why shouldn't I?
I can understand that, because I've heard people who are drug dealers use the same rationale. But when you got to think about it, is you're hurting somebody else. And what gets you to the point where you have it in you to actually hurt somebody else? It's not easy, but you have to look at the feeling behind the feeling. Initially, you're robbing people because you need to get stuff and support your family. You don't want to see your mom working so hard. But where does the anger come in? Maybe you blame yourself for why her relationship with Jose didn't work, so that you cost your family some stability in that respect, and then your mom had to go back to the two-job thing. That comes from someplace inside of you, and it's not the easiest thing to recognize. It's deep in there, and it takes some work.
Like what you're telling me now, stuff that like I really don't think of. And I just want to, you know, thank you for listening to me. Thank you for having this conversation with me. I mean, it was really nice for you. And it's thank you. I mean,
anytime. You give me hope. and I need you to understand that that's coming from the heart.
All right, I mean, okay, cool. I'm not going to cry. All right, thanks.
So far, I've talked about how I don't trust that I've actually changed my street mentality after giving up my life of crime. But now let me speak about what made me stop. At around November 2005, my life was far from cheerful. I was failing my classes and disappointing everyone around me. My friends tried to reach out to me, but I just wanted everyone to get off my case. I didn't like being home because the apartment was usually quiet because no one wanted to speak to me. When my mother tried to talk, it would always spark an argument and end with my mother locking herself in her room and me leaving the apartment until later at night. By December 2005, I'd managed to become distant from everyone I loved. I was losing sleep because I was selling drugs every night and yet waking up early every day to make it to class. Trying to be a high school student and keep my street credibility was an exhausting task. One night, I came home late and had an argument with my mother. I can still vividly remember what happened that night. I get home, my mom's like, "Lewis, what happened to you?" Like, she's all worried. I'm like, "Yo, calm down, mind your business." And then, like, she starts screaming at me, "This is my business, you are my business," and this and that. And I said, "Yo, shut up and mind your business." I really got loud with her. And then I just go to my room. And then I'm there, like, you're sitting there just trying to calm down. Because I usually take a long time to, you know, try to release, like, my anger and this and that. But then I was kind of like, I should go ahead and go say sorry to mama. So I leave my room, I walk the hall, I go to her bedroom. But her door is like mostly closed, but just a little bit is open. Then I start hearing her on the phone, like she's having a conversation. So I start being nosy and just listening. Like, so she's talking to my grandmother and she's crying. She's talking about me. She's talking about like, "Oh, like, what did I do wrong? Why did Lewis turn out this way? Like, it's all my fault, it's all my fault." And she's crying on the phone, like she could barely talk, like she's skipping words, she's not finishing words because she's crying. When I heard that, like, I felt like I was trying to hold my tears. So like, I can describe it as like my heart just getting flooded with like all the tears, and like I felt like my heart like it was being squeezed. I felt like my mouth was dry. I felt my mouth completely dry, and I was like, how could I, you know, be like this? How could I make the woman that has, you know, raised me and all that, how can I make her cry like that? I felt like a monster. And then I just walked away, like, with my head down. I just walked away and I went to my room and I started crying even more. And, you know, just stayed in my room and I decided, you know what, I might as well just go to sleep. But I couldn't get the idea, like the thought that I had the whole event out of my head. So I stayed up like the whole night and I just decided that I needed change. But change didn't come that easy for me. Depression hit me hard after I gave up crime. When I stopped selling drugs, I became a traitor to the people I dealt with. All the respect that neighborhood gave me was gone. I felt hurt because that respect was the only power I had. I wasn't doing good in school. I wasn't a good son, I wasn't making the amount of money I made before, and I didn't have anyone to talk to. I felt worthless. Dealing with depression was a struggle, but focusing my attention on my job and seeking help from social workers in my school helped me conquer it. It was a long process, but ultimately, I learned to express my emotions more freely and managed to strengthen the bonds between me and my family. It's now April 2007. Over a year has passed since I decided to change. Sometimes I find myself reminiscing on the times I was a bad boy or boasting to my friends about the negative life I lived. When I first started this project, I thought of those things as warning signs, signs that I haven't completely erased my past. But talking to these people, to Silvio, Eugene, and Erica, and thinking about my life, I've realized that I can't make my past disappear. I try to make a distinction between my old self and my present self, when in fact we're the same person. The past has made me who I am today.
Running From Myself was produced by Lewis, who decided not to use his last name, with Anthony Mascaro from 826 NYC, with help from transom.org. This hour comes to you from the public radio website, transom.org, where you can get the tools to tell your own story. You can read manifestos by great radio producers and find out what microphone to buy. Drop by anytime, transom.org. This hour was produced with support from the National Endowment for the Arts, who believe a great nation deserves great art, and from the Ford Foundation at fordfoundation.org. Thanks to WCAI, the Cape and Islands NPR station. I'm Jay Allison from Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Thanks for listening. This is HearingVoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of SoundImagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is HearingVoices.com.